So tonight we'll talk about St. Teresa of Avila. Next week I'm going to do Ananda Moy Ma, so that we'll put a little bit of India in between these great Catholic, interestingly both Italian, no, I guess St. Teresa's Spanish, so a little different, but sort of same area and a lot of the same teachings. And please, as I said, let's just make it informal. I have the ability to speak as long as there's room for me to speak, but I don't need to do it that way. I actually love responding to questions or comments, so, and then it makes it much more about us. One of the reasons that I love reading about saints and all of their lives, whoever they are, I don't know how many of you or who of you have actually spent time reading about lives of saints. All of you, great, yeah. Raised Catholic, yeah.
Did you have that little book, The Book of Saints? And it was a little book, they still have it in print. It's like printed in the 50s.
Were you all raised Catholic? You too, Marilyn? No. Yeah. When I was talking with B. Raj this afternoon, we had a meeting, and he said, tell me when you're doing Ananda Moy Ma, because I want to come. He said, these Catholic saints, I grew up with them. I know all about them.
Really?
So, I don't know how they're presented in Catholic teaching, but hopefully we'll get a different, broader perspective on their teachings.
Yeah, I was just going to say there's a different slant when you do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
It makes more sense.
Well, one of the reasons why it's been such a joy for me, I was born and raised Jewish, so I knew nothing about these saints, but learning about these saints, including Jesus. Hi, Arthur. Welcome. Is because I am fascinated with this knowing in the world of how all great teachers are telling us the same exact story. I started years ago studying comparative religion, and it's also very different when you're doing it academically. If you're sitting at Stanford University trying to take comparative religion classes, it's not that they're not good, and I shouldn't single out Stanford. I just happened to do it there, but I'm sure if one does it anywhere. It's just in an academic environment, probably very much like these saints' lives themselves, the inspiration loses something in the telling. One of the things that all of these saints have lived through, but St. Teresa speaks of it so beautifully in her. You know, she's written 5 books. Actually, she wrote them in the span of these 20 years of her life when she went through all of her hardship, which we'll talk about. She didn't really blossom and be able to come out with her teachings until she was in her middle 40s, which for the 1500s was actually rather old. What she found is that when she wanted to confess to somebody and she was feeling great agony about something, it was hard for her to find anybody to confess to who could really grasp her vision, her agony, whatever it was at the time. She was certainly a woman who knew a lot about agony on every level. And again, I'll come back to her life, but just want to set the stage for the saints here, because so few people who want to teach us about religion have actually had these experiences themselves. Mostly we're being taught by people who teach us what they've learned from books. And did I talk about this in the chakra class on Saturday? I'm sorry, I've done so much teaching in the last couple weeks, I'm getting confused. Well, you too, because you were here in that class. If you hear the same thing again and again, just assume we're all meant to hear it again and again. Yeah, then it's true. It's the truth, exactly. Yeah, I used to be much more upset about that till I would go and hear Swami speak days in a row and hear him tell the same story. And I always thought to myself, just open to it. What can you learn now? What can you learn now? And every time I listen to that man tell the same story, even no matter how many times it comes up, it has that quality because it's the truth of that ever newness that one can find in on a spiritual path. I'll say for you, Kevin, and for any of us who haven't heard it enough, that the essence of the teachings at Ananda but probably the underpinnings of all of the great religions are what are called Sanatan Dharma, which really speaks about those truths that underlie all great religions. So all of the teachers, if we really read them with an open mind and carefully, whether it's Buddha, Krishna, Moses, Jesus, and we could go on and on, anybody who's had an experience of the divine, they're teaching us exactly the same thing. Because, as Swami Satchitananda, who was a very great Indian saint who lived in this country for many years and who just died not that many years ago, said, truth is one, but paths are many. So no matter how we find our way to that truth, it's that truth that these great saints are trying to teach us. So no matter who they are, they're all telling us the same thing. And it's part of the joy of reading about these saints who lived at very different times. We'll hear when we talk about Ananda Moy Ma, in different centuries, if not separated by 1,000 years. And yet, as you read what they're writing, you realize that they are, every one of them, telling us exactly the same thing. I started to say a word about Sanatan Dharma, which means eternal truth. That's how it translates. The word for the experience of God, for the experience of those truths in Sanskrit, is Satchitananda. And Sat means truth, Chit means the essence of that truth, and Ananda means bliss. But the way Yogananda defined it, which was new, is ever conscious, ever aware, ever new bliss or joy. And it's that ever newness that you feel no matter how many times we hear these stories, which is what brought me all the way around with that little story. But Satchitananda and the ever newness of it, and you never tire of hearing it because it's the truth. It resonates with something so deep in our soul that when we know it, we realize it. So here's a woman who lived in the 1500s, and I brought just a couple of books. This book is a really remarkable book. It's an older book called The Saints That Moved the World, and mostly I'm going to speak from it tonight. I'm going to open it and actually speak from it because it's, I think I will. I'll probably get there. I hope I do, actually. Because, you know, when these saints speak, there's no fat in what they say. You find that there's hardly even a pronoun in there that you want to leave out. So sometimes just quoting them is the way to do it. And I think you'll see, for those of you who have done these book studies with Asha often over the years, she'll open a book and read it because you can explain the truth for a while if you want, but it's very hard to paraphrase it. But there are several books about her that I read just to feel her energy and get ready to be here and to share about her for an hour and a half. Just a remarkable woman born in a particularly remarkable time. She was born in the year 1515. And if we stop and remember what was going on in the world at the time, that's always telling for us to understand why these great saints are teaching how they're teaching. Moses had a very different message to bring to the Jews when he brought it than Jesus had to bring to the Jews when he brought it. And Krishna came at a different time and shared his wisdom with Arjuna in a different culture at a different time. Again, all the same teachings, but Moses didn't sound exactly like Jesus. You know, he had a different tone about him. And in his teachings, you can hear it, you read it, it sounds very different at first reading than when you sit down to read the New Testament. But when you actually begin to understand what they're both saying, that's when you realize that it was the truth, the same truth, but they had to speak to whoever they were speaking to at the time. So Teresa was born in 1515. She was born into a time where the world literally was just being discovered. This world was just being discovered. right up until the time she was born, or not that many years before, people were convinced the world was flat. I was thinking about it because I thought, you know, the globe was just being discovered. I mean, that is really what was happening. She was born in 1515, but in 1492, Columbus was just sailing. Magellan was just sailing around that time. He had literally sailed around the world. Cortez was going off and discovering Mexico and and it was Magellan who discovered the Philippines. I mean, these people were really out there discovering the globe. Just last Tuesday morning when we were having one of our staff meetings, we were talking about what it is. We started the discussion because we were talking about relating to the younger people who are looking for a spiritual path. Ananda's been around for 40-some years now, and many people who are here now have been involved with Ananda for 40-some years. People like myself who came a little later, but not all that much later. You know, we're all in our 60s now, and we have a lot of people who are 20-something or in their late teens or maybe 30 who are coming to Ananda, and we're saying, how are we going to grab them? Because as I pointed out in the meeting, we now look like their great-grandparents, you know? And we forget that because, as I say to them all the time, and Kevin, you're probably the only person here who doesn't know that I'm a physician and a very busy physician in the world, so I've had a huge number of experiences with my patients and clients. And just in the last few years, I was having this experience in medicine, too. I wound up working for the last few years exclusively in the field of chemical dependency. So I was working a lot with younger people. And all of a sudden I could feel that how it was that I would have credibility with them really had to change. Because they were coming in, it was fine when I was sort of a maternal figure for them. That was okay. But all of a sudden I was the grandparent for them. And you know how people look at you and respect you and sort of the weight of what you say, how much weight it holds, really starts changing. It's a little different here because people who are called to hear spiritual truths, and in a way, age might have a sort of advantage in that way because we tend to think of older people as wiser. Of course, that's not at all always true, but it might help us here. But anyway, we were talking about the influences on young people and what they're up against, and this study that they just did that showed how often young people, and they were looking at high school students and just immediate high school graduates, how often what they're learning and what they believe to be the truth comes from a Google search. So they look something up on Google, and the first thing that they find, and usually they'll go to Wikipedia or wherever, and that's their truth, how much they just accept it and how the world's changing like that. And I said in that meeting, I just heard that study, so I shared that. And I said, but the other thing that's so profound and so different in the world today is the global nature of everything. And I was saying, you know, it's just nothing for people to grow up. I have many clients in my practice now who within a year will spend time with friends on 5 different continents. It's nothing. Everybody Skypes. Everybody has phones that goes to every country in the world. She spends, one of my clients, 3 hours a day talking to her friends in England or in India. It's just remarkable how the world has changed. Well, when I was reading some of these books about Teresa, I realized that she was living in a world that felt exactly like that. I mean, it just must have been no different. Now we're doing it through phones and internet, but suddenly, the world was changing from a world where people at least had been making an effort to look in to one where everything about life was saying, look outside. Oh my God, look at this. There are all these continents that we knew nothing about. And guess what? When we take our boats there and we come back, we can bring back things that you never dreamed existed. Different dyes and gold and jewels and silk and all kinds of fabrics and things that, you know, the American Indians were making. I mean, and the South American Indians. I mean, all of these priceless and new, they were the jewels of the day, the things that would say to people, listen, everything you need to make you happy is really out here, and we're going to prove it to you. And the world was turning to become an extremely materialistic place. It's just fascinating to realize how much like our time it was. It's just the medium was a little different. But the changes that we've lived through, and I say that as somebody who's 65 years old now, I mean, when I was a kid, television had just been discovered. You know, my grandmother, whose home I spent a lot of time at, and, you know, who died not that many years ago, she never had heard of a television. They didn't exist. I mean, when you think about airplane travel, I grew up without computers. You know, I remember how people kept yelling at me and yelling at me because I was a physician and extremely busy in those days to get a cell phone, but they were new and big and clunky, and I didn't want to carry a cell phone. I was happy to stop at payphones. They were everywhere. Literally. I mean, it's just amazing. I was called 15, 20 times a night, and I would just go to a payphone if I was out. It's so incredible. But again, it's just the medium that's changed. But for them, the same thing was going on. And that's what she was being born into. And it was right around the time of the Inquisition. I mean, literally, people were being burned and tortured for having any unusual experiences or beliefs. I mean, when you think then, and this is just all so crucial for what it means that these saints were born when they were born. Not just what they had to deal with, but why did they come? If we think about what was going on in terms of science, because another thing that struck me, because Teresa, like so many great saints, really suffered with major illnesses. She suffered every day of her life, as did St. Francis, and we'll talk about him in a few weeks. But it's not uncommon for these people, for these saints, when you read about them, for them to have had lives that were filled with suffering and often physical suffering. Many of you, I'm sure, have all of you now read this new, other than you, Kevin, I'm sorry, because I know Kevin's just, she's been around for a couple of months now, and it's wonderful, and she feels very drawn here, but the biography, has anybody read the biography yet? So Swami Kriyananda wrote not that long ago, I think it came out maybe about 3 months ago max, that it was actually published, wrote a biography of Yogananda. It's a phenomenal book if you want to learn about, because the autobiography of a yogi, which I know you've already read, it's not really in some ways an autobiography. It's the biography of his guru and that lineage. He tells many more stories, if you remember, about these teachers behind me than he does about himself. He shares a lot about himself, but it's not really a book about him. So Kriyananda just wrote this book. And one of the things that becomes imminently clear to us when we read that book and John Parsons' book, The Fight for Religious Freedom, is how much both Swami Kriyananda and Yogananda have gone through in their lives. In John Parsons' book, it's just laid out for you as a parallel. Here's an exact parallel. Swami Kriyananda was sued. Here's all the time that Yogananda was sued. Swami Kriyananda was thrown out of SRF and betrayed by all these people. Here's all these people who betrayed Yogananda. If you haven't had a chance to read it, definitely read that book, A Fight for Religious Freedom. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal book, a handbook about how to develop devotion and dedication and commitment to your spiritual path. It really is. Well, Teresa lived through that time, and one of the things that struck me as I was reading about it, because she was so sick, is that there was no medicine to speak of. I mean, there was no Western medicine to speak of at the time. There were no drugs. Nobody knew anything. The person who had first done a dissection of the human body was alive during her life. This is within decades all this happened. You know, everything about gravity, I mean, we can just go on and on, such incredible You know, Copernicus was alive around the time with everything just beginning to talk about astronomy. So people's minds were being engaged in every way. You know, it's hard to tell. I don't know. I'll talk a little bit about it, but it's very hard to tell. I think she probably had a profound and extraordinary metaphysical disease that we'll never get to define. But it could sound like that, but not completely, as they describe it. And again, I read several books about her now. Everybody describes it the same. I think they're really taking it right from her writings about it, because she wrote so prolifically, which is wonderful. Feels like a long time ago to us, but when you can actually read her work, I found it hardest to read her book, because it's written, it's written in the 1500s, and that I don't exactly resonate with that. And it's also written from an extremely Christian point of view, somehow I don't understand that the same way I understand these teachings. So, but everybody else who's written all of these other books or comments about Teresa, probably getting it from her own writings and from the writings of other people. And I think it's very hard. I will read to you something tonight about what this author in this book, The Saints That Change Our Lives or Moved Our Lives, Moved the World, Saints That Moved the World, wrote about her illness. It's really fascinating. And I think he or she actually very brilliantly came on to something. But anyway, that's what she was born into, and she was born, as you probably all know, she was the daughter of a relatively wealthy man who was very strict. He was a staunch Christian. He was adoring of his children. She was the product of his second marriage to a woman who sort of disappeared energetically. I think she liked to get lost in what we would call the fiction of our time. I think she liked to read thrillers, and he was adamantly opposed to that. He was much more intellectual and every night read to the children from all of his books. So she came from a really strong family, a prosperous family. But as she hit puberty, what is abundantly clear is that she really hit puberty. I mean, she just came out. She was beautiful. She was apparently very sensual. I think nobody's come out and said it, but she was always the life of the party. It seemed like she liked to go to a lot of parties for many reasons. She was just out there. She loved to laugh. People loved to laugh with her. She sounds like she had a huge amount of magnetism right from the time she came in, but was really not thinking much about religion, which fascinates me in a way. I think she and Francis probably shared that in some way. And then what happened to her, though, is that her mother died. And when her mother died and her older sister got married, it was considered in those days inappropriate to keep a young woman in a home without an older female figure. So she was sent off to boarding school, and of course the boarding school she was sent to had a very strong Catholic background. And something happened to her. Again, I don't know that it's explicable in terms of the mind, but she developed an intense fear of going to hell. It really is where she focused all of her energy. She was not terribly interested in going to heaven. She was not drawn by anything positive, I mean, in her own words, over and over. But she was terrified that she would go to hell. So because of that fear, she started trying to focus on prayer. And this also was very interesting to me in view of last week's Sunday service. The topic of our Sunday service last week was faith is a call to prayer, prayer is a call to faith. And anybody who was at Sunday service heard me speak about, I hope it was clear what I was talking about. I'm never sure by the time I finish those sermons about whether the point got made or not. But that prayer, once we truly understand the nature of prayer, it is so much more than simply a dialogue with however we hold God, but that in fact it becomes the medium through which we know God. And I don't mean understand him. I mean the more we pray, the more deeply we pray, the more earnestly we pray, the more devotion we bring to our prayers, all of those qualities that would have us be serious spiritual seekers. And so the words steadfast, loyalty, devotion, those kinds of words that we would want to bring to our spiritual search, if we bring that to our prayer, if we begin to pray with the consciousness of those qualities, that what our prayers soon become, soon, of course, is a relative term, but we'll hold it up as an affirmation for soon, is a communion with God, that it quits being a dialogue and it becomes progressively more and more an experience of the divine. And I think that all of these people who were mystics, and particularly Teresa, because her teaching was about prayer. I mean, this beautiful little book, this is interesting. I'm sure I've known this, but it never sunk in with me. We have a chant that we sing here at Ananda all the time. Let nothing disturb you, nothing affright you. All things will pass, but God changes not. Patience, endurance brings you to victory. Once you have God, you'll want nothing more. And it's a beautiful chant. And interestingly and appropriately, the way we're all taught to chant, which is not us, and I realize that, you know, these things that come to us through Yogananda, who's our teacher, but who's an avatar. So he, too, is one of these great saints who's perceiving the truth and finding ways to share it with us. So this repetition of a chant over and over and over, and for those of us who have spent years doing kirtan, I'm in this couple of years of my life, I can't come as often on Friday nights, but for years I came every Friday night. And you just chant and chant and chant, and inevitably, if you're not leading the chanting, you find yourself at some point no longer singing out loud. You might start again with the next chant because it's new and it grabs your mind again, but as you take each chant in deeper, you begin to attune yourself with the vibration of that chant, and you become it. That is that vibration. You're in tune with that vibration. These chants that we do, and many other chants that we don't do that are in other churches or on spiritual paths, they're inspired. These words and melodies are all inspired. They were perceived by Yogananda and Kriyananda. So singing them is different than just making up a melody. If you go out and you attune yourself to the Beatles or Prince or whoever it is, that's where your energy's at. The more you focus on that, the more you become that. It's just simply the truth. And there are times where that's great. If you want to go out dancing one night, you probably don't want to take a CD of Swami's chants because it's just not going to let you get to the same energy. But if you want to be changing your energy, transforming it now, raising it up, having it be more expansive, then you'd be better off singing these chants. But you find that as you become more and more deeply attuned to the vibration, it's less of an outward experience and an inward and more of an inward experience. And you become it, which is why we do it. And that's exactly what Teresa was doing with prayer. She was a saint who very much focused on prayers, so I started to tell you. It wasn't until I saw this neat little book down at East West a couple of weeks ago, I said, oh, that's interesting, let nothing disturb you, that I realized, and again, I'm sure I've known it, that that's where the words are to our chant. It's one of her prayers. I didn't remember that, but it's completely her prayer. It's not, I did find it in here, and I'm not going to look for it again right now. It's not word for word. Probably didn't fit as nicely to the music. But it is, let nothing disturb you, nothing affright you. And I think she says, don't let anything frighten you, or she's saying it more like she's talking to people and not chanting it. I thought at the end of the night we would do, just pick out, these are a wonderful series of books that I just found in their 30 Days in the Company of a Saint. And this was the one from St. Teresa, so it's 30 days of what she does. And we'll do number 11 tonight because this is the 11th. No, it's today's, what is the day today? 7th. Oh, my goodness, why did I think the 11th? Something, but then we'll do the 7th. But I don't know what it is, so it'll be a surprise to all of us. So, again, I just found it. It was just one of those quirky little things that I go to pick up her book on prayers, and here it is, a chant that we do. You know, it's just so many. Reading these books was really compelling again and again and again to realize, and I know all of you actually very well, so here I am, wherever the term preaching to the choir comes from, that's what's happening tonight. But this absolute joy of finding yet another saint who's telling us exactly the same thing in her own way and with her own life story, but we hear it over and over. So let me just keep an eye on the time here because our clock's gone. I want to make sure we get a little break. So what happened with Teresa? She went off to this school, and she developed an absolute fear of going to hell. I mean, a dread fear, which drove her to wanting to pray a lot, which she never, ever, until the age of 45, and really never in a way in her whole life, put down this sense that she was never doing anything well enough. Now, I don't know, because I don't speak Catholicism. It's not my language. So I don't know how much of it is a language that came through because she was Catholic, but it has that ring of this incredibly, particularly early on in her life, really self-deprecating, you know, or that way that we can all get. I often, when people come to me with just talking about the spiritual path, one of the things that I've seen over all the years, and any of you who have spoken to me with any depth or seriousness about your path have already heard me say this, that if we get too dogmatic about this path, any path that we're on, we begin to make it so narrow with all of the shoulds and I'm supposed to, and that there's no way for us to stay on it as human beings. It just gets so narrow, we're going to fall off the path. We have to. You know, so it's so important to help all of us, to help ourselves. I'm absolutely guilty of this because part of my karma in this life has been about learning to be less hard on myself, more self-accepting, and really in the end, to have this deep, deep practice of remembering I'm not doing anything. God's doing it all through me. So it can't be good, bad, right, wrong. It's impossible. My job is just to stay open as an instrument and let Divine Mother work through me. And of course, that's what I always want to do. On the way to becoming 65, I have spent many sleepless nights, because why? I gave a talk to a community of seniors and it wasn't perfect, because I spoke to this person a little harshly and I probably hurt their feelings, because I didn't see the diagnosis in a patient in 15 minutes. I had to call them back later that night and say, wait a minute, it just came to me. It doesn't matter what it is. And when I used to believe that some of my sermons were bad, that was good for not sleeping for a week. You know, it's just, you know, it's really remarkable. I mean, I'm just saying the truth. So I'm not saying, like, just when other people speak to me. It's not even that I've lived through it. I'm still living through it. It's way different now. Fortunately, most nights I tend to sleep well, but it's always right there hunting me. And, you know, like all of us, I came into a life that was going to affirm that for me. You are no good. You're never going to really do it quite right. You're not as smart as you think you are. You're not as pretty as you think you are. Why do you always sing? You really have an awful voice. That was all the feedback I got, so that whatever this soul needed as she, in this lifetime she, but as this soul was progressing on its journey, I came into the perfect environment to get to deal with that, which was not, has not been terribly pleasant, but it's been great grist for my spiritual mill. I mean, it's true for all of us, right? Yogananda says, there are no obstacles, only opportunities. And I think if we see everything that way, so I'm not complaining about this life, quite the contrary. You know, I've come to be, it's interesting. Marilyn, go ahead.
See, that's what I don't get about the saints. They, and even Sister
Gyanamata.
I couldn't stand it.
Sister Gyanamata was considered to be Yogananda's most advanced female disciple. Highly evolved being. Go ahead.
I couldn't stand reading it. And all I could think, well, I'm just absolutely not getting anything because everybody else was falling all over the book. And
she wrote a book called God Alone.
Oh, okay. Is that the book you're talking about?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, you know, and so, and then, you know, like some of these other saints, they're so
self-deprecating.
Deprecating. And I don't see how they can function. They must mean something else when they say they're a lousy, rotten person.
I think they really do. I think that's really, and I would have gotten back to that, but you're making the point because that's where I started. No, they believe it. But they believe it in a, let me just see if it's in this book. No, it's in a book that I didn't bring. I'm sorry about that because I would love to just read to you from it. Nearly the biggest part of the first chapter of another wonderful book that I read about her, and if you're interested in borrowing it, sitting right on my dining room table, really talks about, because that author keeps saying, for the current day Western mind, this is very hard to read or hard to imagine, or why would she have thought this? And he doesn't really, in the end, pretend to exactly know, but he's saying, first, he says we don't really know what was going on in her mind because she keeps apologizing over and over. She does in all of her writings for not doing it well. And it's not the first time I've tried to read about Catholic saints where that starts. And it's been very, very difficult for me. I mean, that's where I started talking a while ago. But I think, you know, boy, let me just see if I can get my mind around what he said, because in the end, it made more sense to me. He said, I don't even think it's that she's holding herself to a higher standard. It's that there's something in the essence of her being that understands perfection. And the way that she behaves in the world, not from a psychological or judgmental point of view, but was vis-a-vis perfection. Because even when she was young, and she wouldn't have looked this way, she was out there, she was a playful, sensual, probably sexual young being, and very precocious in a time where women, you know, were not allowed to be free thinkers. They were, I mean, it even says in one of the books I read about her, I'll come back to that, that it was never, that the two things that women of her day could do was that they could either get married or go to a convent. Those were their choices. Women weren't out living alone. And they said she wrote over and over, when she was afraid of marriage, she did not want to get married. It was never a fear of sex. And everybody says that, because for so many, if people actually are still virgins when they get married, people are typically very afraid of sex. It's really hard to walk into that the first time. You're less afraid when you're 13 or 14 or 15 and your hormones are raging. You're not in your mind enough to be afraid. But if you've gotten to be a little older and you're getting married and having sex for the first time. So they pointed that out. But they said the idea of obedience was hard for her. I think in a way what we're seeing here is the difference, almost like when Jesus calls himself the Son of God or the Son of Man. And he means dramatically different things by it. As we all know. I mean, we'd have to say that. So when he's talking about Jesus the man, he would respond one way in the world. But the Son of God, that manifestation of pure divine energy, would behave another way. I don't know, we'll never know, if it was conscious for her, but I think she lived from a place of knowing about the oneness and the perfection of being. And she was, obviously, in this lifetime. Whether she was born an avatar or not, I don't know. I mean, how could I know? It's not mine to say. And she didn't live the beginning of her life that way. But certainly, she started having mystical experiences very early on in her life.
Could she have been impersonal? That would explain it.
Yeah, well, that's actually probably as good an explanation as any I've read. And it's a perfect word. You know, it's what's interesting about Teresa is that she was not strictly that way. She really wrestled. It's very comforting, actually, to read about her in that way, because she was very attached to material world, to sensual pleasures, to the joys of social life. I mean, very attached. I want to share some of the stories of what happened to her when she came back, when she actually finally went into the convent. And after she started having some mystical experiences, because it's, I don't know, for me, it helped me feel so much more accepting of myself, which is, I think, in large part why these saints exist. Now, I don't know if any of you have had actually mystical experiences. Maybe people in this room have had visions. You know, they're not all that uncommon. But probably most of us have not lived in ecstatic states for days or months, or there was one period where for even 3 years she lived in a state of ecstasy. What that looked like from the outside in was one thing, and what other people were calling it. But she lived in it. So we're not saying that, at least as of right now, and again, I don't want to speak for anybody else, because how can I know other than the fact that I've sat and had long conversations with at least half of you? But for the other half, I don't really know what your experiences in life are. I hope they're like what Teresa was having. But, you know, for most of us, that's not the case. But so for me, it helps me see a little bit about the path from here to there, because she actually had to live it. She describes very clearly in her teachings, after she started having these ecstatic experiences, and she levitated a couple of times, which was really what got everybody's attention, because otherwise it was just her word against theirs. But when people actually saw her levitating, of course, in those days it was nothing to just say, you're a witch, we're going to burn you at the stake for levitating. But fortunately, there was always somebody in her world. I mean, obviously, you know, that's what Jesus was doing for her, was really placing people there to save her. So the stories, and we will not at all have a chance to go through all of them, but at every critical moment in her life, a savior appeared in one form or another. Just when you would think, what's going to happen to her now? And literally, when there were crowds screaming, take her to the Inquisition, take her to the Inquisition, meaning put her on trial, and everybody was sure she'd be found guilty, or when there was no way in the world that she would get money to start her first convent, or over and over. Even this story, this extraordinary story, I won't forget where I was, by the way, about what happened with her visions. I will come back to that maybe after our break. But even when she had the height of her illness, and for 4 days, when it's not just comatose, but rigid, ice cold, the doctors came in, the doctors were called, they put a finger under her nostril, or a mirror, or something, I don't even know if they had mirrors then, but something like a mirror, and they couldn't see her breath, and they couldn't feel a pulse, and they said she was dead, and her father was saying, my daughter is not dead. And then the nuns went, and the nuns dug her grave. They were asked to dig her grave, and they carried her body back to the convent on a sheet, and the father went running after it and stopped and said, you are not burying her. She is not dead. I mean, in that instance, her father was the savior. You know, they thought he was crazy, but they were so, their hearts were touched by a father who was being driven crazy. And he kept saying, I know for certain my daughter is not dead. And of course, 4 days later, she woke up and that afternoon was walking around talking to people like nothing had happened. So at every point in her life, you know, somebody appeared. But she lived through a lot of torment. So let me just finish this story before, and then we'll take a short break. She was having these ecstatic experiences and levitating. So the convent, the Carmelite convent that she was a part of, decided that it would be very meaningful for her to go down and talk to people who wanted to come and see her. And they felt that way for a lot of reasons. I mean, it was probably not simply because the other nuns believed that she was a great being and should share her spiritual wealth, but because the Carmelite order was extremely poor and they wanted to draw a lot of the people who would support the convent with their money. So every single day they had Teresa go down and sit behind a grate and talk with these people. And Teresa started doing it, and she was trying to answer questions about an experience she was having in a whole other reality from anything anybody had experienced. And she started realizing that there was no way in words to connect the two worlds, which is simply the truth. I mean, we don't have to be living 3 days in ecstatic experiences to know, I can tell you from my own experience, that so much of the spiritual path is experience. That's why if people want to doubt, and I mentioned last Sunday this whole thing of positive doubt or negative doubt, and I wanted to speak about that on Sunday more than I actually wound up, because I know who I'm looking out at when I'm giving a sermon. And I know people out there who have a lot of negative doubt. That is, they're coming to prove a point. They're coming not to say, I have questions. Show me how this is the truth. How could this be so? Which is a positive kind of doubt, because that is what takes us beyond just believing in something to having this faith, knowing beyond a doubt that it's true, because we know, but we can't know in this, we can't know through our minds. Because these spiritual experiences are just that. We have to be able to have an experience that's beyond mind, that happens in another, literally another reality, another level of consciousness, before we know for absolute certain that these spiritual teachings are true. Now, for many of us, we've had it, as I said, because our hearts have been touched, because something's happened to us that makes us believe in this. So how do we come in, those of us who came in absolutely just knowing that reincarnation's real? The vast majority of people in the world do not believe in reincarnation. But what's ever happened to us, it doesn't have to happen in this lifetime. Maybe it happened in the last lifetime or 1,000 lifetimes ago. But something has us. We've had an experience where we know. It's not just an intellectual belief. So Teresa got to the point where she realized that she couldn't share. She couldn't make that jump from this world of ecstatic experiences and communing with Jesus and seeing him and being spoken to him to talk to these people who wanted to ask her what were fairly mundane questions. That was one thing. But the next thing that happened that took her right off her path. Imagine this woman's having these experiences. She's levitating. And people came in, and before you would know it, the discussions would go the way of discussions. Did you hear about what happened to so-and-so? And look at this gorgeous ring that my husband just bought off the ship that came back from America. And have you heard about the finest silks? And do you hear what's happening politically? And this is what's going on about war. And she was a great, as I said, she was always the center of the party. She loved to talk. She loved to read. She loved to learn new things. She loved to hear new things. She would go back to her room. She would then fall into one of these ecstatic states, and she would remember, what was I just doing down there? Tomorrow I have to tell myself I am no longer of that world. But tomorrow would come, and she would just fall into it. And she, in fact, would start saying, tell me more. Then she would say to herself, you're not going to go. When that bell rings, you are not going downstairs. It was literally downstairs. You will not go because you don't seem to have the ability to resist temptation. That was her temptation. Just like food might be for us, or sex, or a drink, or television, or reading a crappy novel, or sleeping in on a Sunday. Doesn't matter what it is. It's so touching to me to read that she talks about, this is part of what she was, this tortured her. It tortured her. She couldn't resist the darn bell. She wanted to go. And when she would try and confess, she went to her father's confessor, that priest, somebody who her father, who was a very religious man and who Teresa loved and respected, had spoken to, gone to for confession all of his life. The priest said, oh, Teresa, it's okay. Of course you want to hear about the things of the world. That's not a sin. I can't find it written anywhere in the Catholic laws that it's a sin. You haven't committed a sin. Get off your own back. Come on down and enjoy it. That's what he said to her. She tried a lot of different people. She started anguishing. She felt so lonely, so completely alone. She was sitting in these rooms of all these people, feeling totally alone, beginning to realize that there was nowhere to go but back to God. Because even the highest spiritual people of her time just had no idea what she was talking about. None. When I read that, and I don't know about anybody else, I mean, I'd be interested to hear from you. I've had so many experiences like that, where I've tried to talk to people, particularly very, very, very dear friends of mine who were friends long before I moved into Ananda. But they're still my friends. But they're not on a spiritual path. I am. I mean, they're on a spiritual path because every human being's on a spiritual path. But they're not seeking it. They're not going after it. They're not interested in learning. They're unconsciously on a spiritual path. Or my family, people that I love. I have learned over the years what to talk to people about and what not to talk to people about. Because it's not that they're bad people. It's not that they... Many of these people want nothing more than to be able to give me something. Because so many of them feel like they no longer have anything to give me. They want to be able to give me something. And if they could help me with anything in the world, they would. But they can't. They simply can't. It's like speaking two different languages, literally, and being upset with the other person for not understanding you. It's not that they don't want to. It's not within their power. That's the world she was living in. Tell me, have any of you had that?
I thought you were describing me.
Yeah.
I mean.
I probably was. Right? Yeah. Well, in a way, it to me, even though, of course, I know I'm not Teresa, but why are these saints incarnating? Why are they born? Because when you look at her and you feel her anguish and what she lived through, and this is just one story I'm telling you, but when you read it, she was drawn over and over and over out into this world. It really lets you feel so much hope for who we are and where we are. And even I know as I say it, because here we are. It's Wednesday night. You know, you have a dog at home that would really love for you to be there. Maybe somebody has children. You know, God knows there's other things we could all be doing. Stacy needs to be sleeping. You know, I'm teasing Stacy. But Stacy's full-time master's degree, full-time work, full-time a lot of things, full-time Ananda, you know? And I mean, we all have stuff we could be doing, but here we are. So we're all looking for this. And so we really need to find some solace in the fact that this is part of the human condition. And it's not, and it's meant to be part of the human condition. It's the force against which we can grow you know? It's just by coming up against stuff. That's why I said before, am I upset that I grew up in a world that was trying to teach me how limited I was? Of course not. What is that strength that would have us say, that's not what I am? The realization in a moment that these people are wrong, what they're telling us, we are so much more than most of us were shown to believe we were as children. Even those of us who grew up in loving homes, how many of us had the chance where people helped us remember moment by moment that we are manifestations of divine energy, that everything Jesus was, we are too, that we have every bit of that in us. Master said there's so much energy in 1 gram of flesh. What did he say? Something about lighting the whole city of Chicago?
For 3 days.
Lighting the city of Chicago for 3 days? Yeah. That in 1 gram of our... He said, you have no idea how much you are. But that's not what most of us... Now, I happen to have been... Not consciously. Nobody was trying to be mean to me. But my mother was limited, and she was afraid, and so she just taught me from that framework. And she passed on her own insecurities, and she did a beautiful job of it to me. You know, but she wasn't trying to. But even people I've seen who've grown up in what would be considered to be very loving homes, wonderful, that's perfect. Teresa was born and raised in a loving home. But rarely are people, you know, her father went and kept bringing her back from whenever she would try and run away to go to a convent initially. I mean, later. You know, he wanted her home. How many people, I've met many, many, many young Indian men here. And when they decide to become a monk or become even very involved with Ananda, they sometimes don't even tell their parents in India for a long time. It's wild. You would think their parents would say, wonderful. So all I'm saying is that very few of us have been helped to see all of what we can be. But so what? We get to discover it like that. And of course, that's what we're all doing because we're here. And we're doing really, in some way, just what Teresa did. And she suffered with it. It doesn't sound like... You know, Yogananda, when you read his life, he never suffered with this stuff. Even when people were suing him, even when he had to find, you know, $30,000 in 3 weeks or months, when he made that famous comment, you know, when somebody said to him, but Master, you'll never, it would take you 3 years. And he said, 3 years for those who think 3 years, 3 months for those who think 3 months, 3 weeks for those who think 3 weeks, you know, with all that more power than I want to scream into this. But I mean, it's just, you know, it's just what it is. It's we're being reminded that there's so much more to us than we know. Even now, even when we're here, even when we're searching, we're awake. Those of us in this room, we're awake. But still, it's impossible for us to get it because we're just not there yet. We can't see, you know. I read the most wonderful, let me see if I can recapture this. Well, I can't recapture it in those words. I'm not even sure it was Yogananda. But the feeling and the teaching was this, and that is each of us comes on this path, and moment by moment, it's like we're holding a cup as we want to realize more and more. But as big as our cup is, that's how much realization we can hold. And it's not like it's good or bad or right or wrong. The more we realize, the larger the cup is, the more we can realize. But we just have to keep going. So wherever we are, it's perfect. It's right where we are. We all can rejoice because we happen to be sitting in this beautiful temple, absorbing these beautiful vibrations, interested in hearing about these wonderful people. We're probably not going to go into 3 days of ecstasy, but we're right where we are, and we can see where she was, and we can see how we keep moving forward. It's a beautiful gift, hearing about these saints and hearing these stories that are true stories. I started to say, I keep saying we're going to take a break. We may not take a break. We may just finish on time. I'm sorry. It's so hard to quit sharing these stories. But what I started to say about Yogananda, which is really the truth, and he did go through a lot. He had enormous trials in his life, which, as I said, you can read about in both his biography and in John Parsons' book. Incredible trials. But you don't get the feeling. I wasn't there. I can only listen to Swamiji talk about it. But, you know, that was just in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. I mean, we have printed pages of what he wrote and said and tape recordings of his voice. It's different than the 1500s. He was challenged by it in that he had to show people how to meet those challenges. How do you come up with $30,000 in 3 months? In the 1930s or 40s or whenever it was, it could be like $3 million now. I don't know what the equivalence would be, but it's like that, the equivalent would be. But he didn't seem like he was personally suffering. You know, he was an avatar who came. He never looked like that. When I read about Teresa, I think she genuinely suffered. She really suffered. She talks very clearly and openly about the agonies of her physical suffering. She tries to describe this pain, and simply you can hear it just gets beyond words for her. She finds there are no words for the physical agony that she lived with. Stacy.
Does she find comfort in God?
No? You know, during those moments when she's suffering, oh, she found huge comfort in God. I mean, she went on. You know, what happened with her that's so amazing is that she really didn't, what is the word I want to use? Because, you know, clearly she was having these ecstatic revelations of Christ. So in those moments when she would be with Christ, she was ecstatic. And she started longing for them before age 45. But it wasn't until age 45 where everything really came together for her, where she could absolutely see very clearly her life's work. She, you know, the Catholic Church really got on her because she started having these ecstatic visions, and she would behave in odd ways, and she was basically leaving her body. But I don't think it doesn't always look the same for everybody. I mean, when that happens, I remember when I went to India with this, many of you have heard me say already that I was at Ananda for many, many years, then I met another spiritual teacher who I stayed with for, I don't really remember how many years I was with Sankeshwa Das, but maybe it was 7 or 8 years, and then I came back to Ananda and moved right into, well, soon after that moved in, and that's been the last 12 years that I was back here. So it was 70s and 80s. Then in the middle 80s, I went out with Sankeshwa Das, and I came back. But I spent a lot of time in India with him. He was really very highly regarded as a saint all over India. And I remember one time we went to a particular place, and he said to me, "Shanti Ma, you've never been to this spot with me." He said, "But in this place, I always have a direct experience of my guru." And he said, I'm going to leave my body. And you're just going to see this body fall." I mean, he told me all this. He said, "I don't want you to be frightened." He just, like, laid it out for me, you know, and he was very sweet. He was a true bhakti yogi, you know, a real man of the heart. And I always wish I had a picture to show people of him when I speak about him. He was cherubic almost. He was just adorable. And he would very often take my face in his hands. I mean, it's very, I clearly needed to be with a bhakti yogi teacher, a real loving, you know. I mean, it was just, I needed that at that time in my life. "Please take me in your arms and just love me to death." And I mean, he didn't literally take me in his arms, but he did love me to death. I mean, the death of that old Shanti, it was so perfect. But he just would take my hands and say, in my face in his hands and say these things to me. And that's what he was just looking at me right then. And we used to take these groups of people over to India. I was always the tour doctor, so I could go, but we would go over, and then I would stay with him. So I would spend months of every year there for many years. So the group would come for about 4 weeks or so, then they'd come back. But anyway, very special time. But that's exactly what happened. I mean, I remember I was so grateful that he warned me. Many other people who were there had already seen it, and they knew, and, you know. But and so then I've watched other people have really ecstatic experiences where they leave their body, and it does. It looks different for everyone. But when I hear them describing Teresa, it just sounds like it did not look pretty from the outside in. You know, it just seems like she was often writhing with something. She did experience a lot of pain. There's a lot of speculation in this book and in others about what this disease, what it was. And, you know, because, I mean, nowadays we could say, was it epilepsy? Because she did have these tonic, her muscles became very tonic, she became very spastic. But she also became cold. She would just stay rigid for days. It doesn't really sound like epilepsy. You know, it doesn't sound like anything that a person could live through. It also doesn't sound like anything that one could describe from a medical perspective. First, I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to get the diagnosis, and there were just no doctors there before, so they couldn't come up with a diagnosis. But it's not what happened. In the end, you read and you read and you read, and you realize, no, they were about to bury this woman. She was not in her body. Her father was there who could feel whatever he was feeling. I think he was so deeply connected with her that he knew. And he kept saying, my daughter is not dead. And as I said before, nobody believed him, but he knew. For all intents and purposes, she looked dead. And many other times, I mean, they took her to what it really in current language would be a naturopath. This woman gave her all kinds of herbs. In fact, she had to wait because this woman could only practice in the spring months when the herbs would be growing. When nothing was working, she would give her stronger and stronger herbs to make her throw up all the time. Teresa got to the point where she couldn't eat, she couldn't walk. I mean, it took her, at one point she was in bed for over 3 years. She just couldn't, she had no strength to get up and move. She was very, very sick. And, you know, nobody ever knew what was wrong. So there was a time where then people started believing she was simply hysterical. People came up with a lot of psychosomatic diagnoses for her, even in that day. But, you know, none of it fits. I mean, none of it fits. None of the even hysteria, I don't think. I think there are simply, you know, when I say metaphysical diseases, I mean diseases about which we cannot know, the reasons for which we cannot know. They're indescribable. In a way, I could say that I now understand, I really think I know for sure, all diseases are that in one way or another. Doesn't matter what it is. It could be a pneumonia, it could be a heart attack, it could be appendicitis, it could be depression, doesn't matter what it is. I'm not saying we shouldn't treat them. I'm an internist. I'm a good internist. I love that I'm a good internist. If you have appendicitis, I promise to take your appendix out. I'm not going to sit there and just say it's a metaphysical disease. Get over it, you know, because we're living in this physical reality. We have to. I mean, it's the saints teach us that too. We need to live in the reality in which we exist. We also, it's essential for us that we are really honest about what our spiritual ability is. Because if we think we're more able than we are, we're in trouble. One of the things that I see all the time in my practice, a lot because of the way I practice, people come to me because they think I'm a doctor who doesn't like medicine, so I'm going to approve of everything they do. It's not at all the case. I love medicine. I love whatever it is somebody needs next for them. There's no one way to treat everything. People come to me with cancers all the time, honestly, to help them die. And that's what I do. I help them die. And somewhere in that, they get that if they had come to me 5 or 6 years ago, they might be able to live. But they were so sure that they had the power to heal themselves. I hear it all the time. people get diagnosed, and some people do. I'm not saying, and sometimes there's also miraculous cures. But people get a diagnosis of cancer who have a little bit of, like, I don't like Western medicine, and they think that they have more spiritual slash energetic power than they have. And it's silly, and it's a shame. It's very sad. So people leave before they had to leave. But anyway, that's all part of their karma, too. The reason I'm saying it is because I don't know that we have the ability to know what was going on with Teresa. I really don't. But I think the human body couldn't have lived through all of what she went through were it simply hysteria or simply any physical disease. I think she would have died. So something was going on with her, some extraordinary kind of a purification that we can't understand. The man who wrote the chapter on her in this book postulates that there's something where the condition, the suffering, the physical decay, everything that's going on every level feeds, is sort of hand in hand working with the spiritual experience. That it is the energy that becomes the transformation. And I think there really is something to that, because it really is a real physical manifestation of this understanding of transformation, which I know to be real. We all know to be real that all energy can be transformed. But spiritual transformation is, again, something that I and perhaps many of us have at least had enough experience with to know that what we hold to be exactly true today, we can change in a deeply spiritual way, and that everything's energy. So whatever was happening to her, that it was all a part of this transformation makes perfect sense. Does anybody have any comments or questions?
I remember hearing that some of the saints, because they didn't gradually, you know, like we learn Kriya Yoga and our nervous systems are ready.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say more about that. That's about all I know. That could be an explanation.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything, Swami?
I don't. I know exactly. Of course, I know what you're talking about. Swami has said it, but every one of the masters on our path have said it, because at some point somebody's come to them who's wanted to be initiated into Kriya Yoga, which is a particular type of meditation that we do here at Ananda. Again, it's not just an Ananda thing. It's a type of meditation that Yogananda taught, but other great masters have taught it too. So, but it is, if somebody comes here and, like, if you keep taking the meditation classes, that's where people go. People want to get to be a Kriya Bond, to be initiated into this particular form of meditation, which is, according to many masters, saints, a very powerful form of meditation. That if you practice it and you practice moving energy in the astral spine, which is what Kriya is about, of course, and you just even in the practice, I was about to say perfect it, but one does not need to be perfect, that in the practicing, that huge amounts of karma are purified, therefore burned up, and that you make much more rapid spiritual progress. Now, what they were saying is not that people are or are not ready for Kriya, although maybe somebody said it, but what these masters talk about a lot is that very often young spiritual seekers come and they want to have an experience of samadhi, of being out of the body, of actually being in that state, which is so hard to describe, first of all, because I've never been there, but second of all, because I know that it's not anything that there are words for. You know, it just simply isn't, except these are all lines from Master's poem, Samadhi, that he wrote, a beautiful poem, trying to share with us, in his words, which he could find, what that experience is. But that there's so much energy. Let me just say it this way, because I can't say it any better. I mean, I can't. I'm at the limits of my. I still have trouble every time I read the chapter in AY on samadhi. It's just, it's profound. It's extraordinary. It's, you know, the end point of everything I'm doing, and it's beyond me. But that we are so in touch with, a part of, every bit of energy that exists, that if you're not ready, rather than being purified, it incinerates. It's like it can incinerate you. If you're not ready for it, it will just blow your mind instead of transporting you. And I think really that's all the truth, even though it's not being said in very great spiritual language. But I do think it's the truth that we have to prepare the vehicle for what's about to flow through it. And we just can't put a huge charge of energy. You know, it's like you can't take a river and run it through a 2-inch pipe. It's just not going to go. You have to work on getting the right conduit that's both large enough and stable enough to handle that experience that you're asking for. I don't know the answer to that question, but my sense is that I don't think Teresa was having an experience that she wasn't ready for. I think she was having experiences that were getting her ready for exactly where she was going. And that's just my feeling from reading. It might sound like a subtle distinction, but it's not. It's not like something was being applied to her that was too much. I don't think, but again, what do I know? I don't think anybody would profess to know that. But it seems to me that what people have, you know, conjured up from all of the documentation that they have is that she was going through a purifying experience. So she did live through it. She could live through it. She grew. She didn't collapse or run screaming from the room, I mean, in a way. You know, she never, and she says this very clearly, she never, although she describes this pain, when you read it, the pain and the weakness and everything, it feels horrible to us. She said, I never wanted to get away from it. She would look from the outside in like she was agonizing, but she said, I never had the experience of wanting to run from it. So she wasn't trying to have it be anything other than exactly what it was, which is in and of itself a sign of really a very highly evolved spiritual being, you know?
That reminds me of Sister Fatima. She was in a lot of pain too, right?
Yes, she lived in a lot of pain. Yeah.
She just was where she was at.
She was completely with it. I mean, she would say she was in pain, but I remember this beautiful story about her. She was also somebody who went to bed sick a lot. And, you know, she was Master's foremost female disciple, but she spent very little time with Master. She didn't travel with him. She wasn't with him. She often wouldn't go into a room when he was there. She would stay away from him. People used to ask her why, and she said, I don't want him feeling that he has to give me anything or do anything for me. She was very, very strong woman, really very powerful woman, but the epitome of humility. And she had such a connection with Master. You know, you read their letters. They're just so in tune and in sync that I also don't think she felt the need. She was with him all the time, whether she was with him physically or not. She was there. But there was a story that she tells in her book, or somebody tells it about her, that she said she was sick and she was in her room and she heard Master either called on the phone, that's it, and somebody answered the phone in her room and was asking for her, and she said, I'm sorry, Master, but you know, she's lying down, and Sister started screaming, not screaming, but yelling, I'm here, I'll take his call, bring me the phone. And she said to the nun later, the other nun, she said, whenever Master calls for me, you get me, no matter what. It was like, it was unimaginable to her that anybody would think that something would happen, that she would be too sick, that she couldn't perform. And she knew, of course she knew, that he would always give her the energy to do whatever she had to do. So she was, again, I don't think, you know, my sense is that it's hard for us to imagine the experience that they're having. You know, it's like I've said to many, many people in a medical setting, when people are watching their loved ones going through something, whatever it is, it might be that they're intubated in the intensive care unit, it might be that they're dying, I don't know, you know, whatever it is. Many times I've said to people, this looks and feels so awful to you, but I want you to know, first of all, I've been around for a lot of this, and very often when these people come back, they either don't remember it or they don't describe a bad experience. But I said, we don't really know what it is for them. It looks worse to us because we're imagining it with our consciousness as we are. So it's very hard for us to be inside of the consciousness of a Gyanamata or of a Teresa. You know, very hard. So we just don't know. But fortunately, I mean, as I said, she says, I was never wanting to get away from the pain.
I was looking at that statement up there when you mentioned, you know, the poem that's mine. Could it have been
the cosmic sea, watch the little ego floating?
Could it be just an extreme demonstration of the letting go of the ego and the body and the pain? And the painfulness of that,
yeah.
While we experience it in our own, you know, small little ways because we aren't saints, but for them, it's like shedding a huge amount of whatever it was she is pulling away from God.
Yeah. So the big question there that, again, you know, I feel inadequate to answer it, but the question's a good one to pose. And that, because we can't know, how much do these saints go through? Because karmically, they're still going through stuff. So if any of them are born and they don't come in as an avatar, the way Jesus came because we needed Jesus, from everything we're taught, he had no more karma to burn up. He did not need to be here. Yogananda's that way. That the great ones, I mean, the ones we know for sure, Krishna. I don't know about Saint Teresa. Was she an avatar? I just don't know. I can't know. So if she has any karma left that she needed to burn up to go on to become all of who she was and to transform, you know, to bring a sense of spirit and wonder and truth back into even the smallest branch of Catholicism, mm-hmm. which had ventured so far away from it. I mean, what she did was monumental. And she also really helped, in a way, revive the Franciscan order because she worked hand-in-hand with those people. So it wasn't just the Carmelites. I mean, what she brought to the Catholic people was huge because what all these mystics did, because they brought the truth. They took these people away from the Inquisition. I mean, what else can we say? You know, people were having ecstatic experiences and seeing, realizing the divine. They were murdered for that. Literally, they were murdered. So somebody like Francis or Teresa comes along, those rare people who the church, which was huge. I mean, again, it's not like 2012. It was so big. Those few people who the church recognized while they were alive. You know, it was known. After Teresa went through a lot, they sent the greatest priests there were to study her. And one by one by one, people had to leave her. It got too weird for them. When she finally said to this final guy who had believed in her all along, forgive me, I'm blocking on his name, and he read and read and read, and he found something in St. Thomas of Aquinas' writings, that because she said to him one day, I'm going to come around to what you're asking, Joe, but this all comes up and it's all important. She said, because she was sharing her experiences with him and he was testing her, the church had sent him, And all along, he kept saying, no, I think her experiences are real. I think they're real. And one day she said, today, for the first time, I experienced God, but he was formless. And she said, and this, I wish I could remember his name, and I'm sorry I don't, this other priest said, well, what did he look like? No, he had no form. Well, what did he sound like? He had no voice. Well, was there any way you could be aware of him? No, he was formless. Well, how do you know he was there? He just let me know he was there. Well, that was it. I mean, now she's psychotic as far as they're concerned. Really, you know, they didn't know the word psychotic in those days, but that's what she was. And even, so then he went and he read and read and read. And people said to him, why are you doing all of this for her? And he said, I'm not doing it for her. I'm doing it because I believe in her. But he had to find proof. So he found these writings. I think it was St. Thomas Aquinas who described a similar experience. And he said, oh, it's real. But eventually, even he had to, for many different reasons, back off. I mean, nobody believed her. Let me just see why I went there from what you're asking. But I think the big difference, the big question here that we can't know is, did she have karma, in which case these experiences were, as you're saying, like the last bit of what she needed to burn up? Or was she, as people say about Yogananda and other great saints, that they have these experiences for us? They either take on our karma and we can see it in them, or they're living through experiences to be an example for how we can do it. Not really because they need to, but because we need spiritual direction. We need example. We need to see that these things are possible. Whether we're Teresa or not, you know, makes me feel much better about myself to see how hard it was for her to resist temptation in the material world. But then also to see that she insisted on continuing to pray when she went back up to her room, and knowing as she did that prayer was not begging God for something, was not just wanting to, it wasn't like confession, and it wasn't just an affirmation. It was a true communing with God, and God kept coming to her. And finally came to her in a vision that this was her real transformation from all of that. It was years down the road. Came to her in a vision that she was transformed, and suddenly everything, you know, really what happened to her? She saw a picture of Christ with this crown of thorns, and she had an experience of his suffering, and she had been an experience. She was him, and she felt so connected to him. And interesting, it was just her way in his pain that suddenly she was repulsed by the materialism. She had been in an incredible flirtation with one man in particular. She had sort of, all these masses were coming to see her, but she had flirted with him, and she was totally coming on to him and seducing him. I mean, she didn't say coming on, but she pretty much does. And she was just about to make that relationship a little more real in some ways. She was a nun. I don't know what she was going to do, but she was totally behaving like she wasn't. I mean, I really mean it. If you read it, you can hear. And the day she went down there with that in her mind, consciously, like, I'm really going to go after him today, she walked by this image of Christ. And she, every temptation was just dissolved. I mean, it's interesting, you know. But it wasn't, she was not consciously making any of this up. She was having these experiences. Obviously, there's a huge amount of divine grace in everything that was going on for her. I mean, obviously. Because as I said, at every turn, something happened right then just to save her. It's interesting watching how it plays out differently in each of their lives. Being as close to Yogananda as we are and hearing as much about Jesus as we do all the time. And it was very different for her, what she went through. But she was saved over and over and over until she had this at 45. And in the last 20 years of her life, she totally revived the whole Carmelite order. She opened 20 convents. She wrote 20 books. Really traveled enormously, and very much like many of them, was sick the whole time, but never. I just tell you one other story. I'm sorry, I know we're a few minutes late. I will finish with this story. This is very sweet because of the story that I just told at Sunday service about Swami Shankaracharya, who was with one of his disciples, a very true disciple of his. This is a long time ago in India. And he was on the opposite bank of the river of his disciple. And the way the story is told, I've read this story many times, just with a sort of smile and a glance, he invited this disciple to come to him across this raging river. And the disciple had no idea. Without a beat's pause, without a doubt, his guru was calling him. He just stepped into the river. And as he put his foot in the river, a big, huge lotus leaf appeared that held him. And then he put his next foot, and these lotus leaves appeared until he got across the river, and he became known. His spiritual name was Padmapada, lotus feet. And, the point about that story, which is so beautiful, which is going to relate back to this story about Teresa, is that that disciple didn't know that his master could materialize lotus leaves. He didn't even give it a thought. He didn't give it a thought because he had faith. And his faith was born of all the experiences he did have with his master. He didn't think, is he going to save me? He didn't think anything. He believed in his guru. And so it just beyond thought, beyond mind, he went to him. And of course, as so many of these stories unfold, and I've just seen enough miracles in my life now, so many miracles, that I know these things happen. Well, interestingly, there's the exact story very near the end of her life when she was feeble. They were going somewhere, and they were in mud that almost, like quicksand, took them down, and now they come to a river. And she had such beautiful energy about her. Talk about the spirit being willing, no matter what the body's like. And she just knew they had to get across, and the nuns wrote that she didn't even stop and think about it. She walked into this icy river, and she just went. So she said, we saw our madre go. So we just followed her. And they said, how we made it through that river, we cannot tell you to this day. But we all made it safely to the other side. Having that pure faith in God, which really means, here's what it means. This is the part that's so beyond words. It means you know for sure that you're one with everything. It means you have removed yourself completely. You've dissolved the duality back into the unity of everything. So you and that river are no longer separate. That river can't hurt you. It can't drown you. You are the river, and the river is you. And when you're one with it, you can walk through it, which is, as I said, how when you have that spiritual, when you're that highly evolved, when the soul has made it to that place on its journey, then we can move mountains, then we can part seas, then we can raise the dead, then we can walk through icy rivers. And it doesn't touch us because we forget that we're separate from it. Smriti, we remember right in the very essence of our soul who we really are. And we're no longer separate from anything, and nothing can hurt us. And that's really what's happened. That's what happened with this river. That's what happens with this illness, is that she knew who she was. And now we can follow in our footsteps. Literally, when we read these stories, we get great courage. We learn a little bit more about how we want to behave when we're sick. How is it that Swami can have root canals done and no anesthesia? He says, oh, I just forget about the body. Well, you know what? Good for you. Good for you. I mean it. Because when we try and do things we're not ready for, we get hurt. And then that's real negative conditioning. Anyway. All right. It was great being with all of you. Thank you so much.